Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut, this is Storied History, and this story is about the Mexican Revolution. The second part. We already did the first part. So you are, if you've not heard the first episode about the Mexican Revolution, you are jumping straight in. You are coming in at the middle because we're just going to keep on going. In the interest of expediency, I will have to be expedient. So if you are coming in the middle, this might not make a whole lot of sense. I suggest you go back and you listen to the previous episode, the one just before this one. All right, so Pancho is in the north, Zapata is in the south, and Madero is running for president. The whole country changed when Diaz's interview was published, welcoming a new opposition party. That's why Francisco Madero got his quote-unquote message from the spirits, that he should write a book about the transition in 1910, and that he personally was destined to be the next president of Mexico. So he publishes this book in 1909 called The Presidential Succession of 1910. In it, he criticizes the concentration of power in one man. He kind of argues against absolutism and about the lack of democracy. He criticized the consequences of the land dispossession and the concentration of the land into fewer and fewer and fewer men and families over time. And he addressed what was happening to the peasants. He talked about the evils of alcohol and illiteracy and the repression of nonconformists. But he did not actually go so far as to criticize the system itself. And this becomes kind of important later on. In the last episode, I said that not everyone was actually on the same side. This is it. They were united against a common enemy for the moment, but when that enemy is gone, what then? Madero very clearly outlines what he thought were necessary reforms, but he believed that they would happen within the existing framework of the Mexican government as it existed at the time. He really wasn't pushing for any radical changes, just kind of a change and shift in power, really. He also took great care not to attack Diaz personally, and that was pretty smart because that would have drawn his anger. He was, in theory, only kind of speculating as to what would happen after Diaz was gone, kind of playing into the question that was asked in the interview that kind of kicked off this whole thing. So the book sells decently well in a population that's almost entirely illiterate, but more importantly, he's got money. He's got a famous name in Mexico, he has family connections, and he is short, unimposing, slightly crazy, and doesn't seem like he would be a threat to anyone. He really doesn't. At this point, he's just this very weird, tiny, rich kid who's just written a book. So he uses his money and his connections, and he forms a little political party, as was happening in the months after that interview. And his personal party is called the Anti-Reelection Party. And surprise, surprise, they nominate him to run for the presidency in 1910. And he does. He's technically not the only one, but nobody else was a real contender. He fully believes that the spirits would guide him and protect him, and also believed that Diaz had been truthful and honest in welcoming an opposition party. So, he's a bit naive, I feel. Maybe more than a bit. He's dangerously naive. And he is a true believer, which is a dangerous combination. So, he actually goes and he campaigns. An actual campaign. Like a real one. A modern one. The way we would think of a campaign. He is going from city to city holding rallies and giving speeches. He was actually doing it in the way that American candidates had been doing it for about 50 or 60 years. Before the radio and television in America, candidates would go from town to town in trains. They wouldn't even bother getting out of the train. It would stop, but that would take too long. So, the train would actually stop at the train yard. You walk out the back of the caboose, you give a speech from the back of the train, and then you go to the next town. It worked in America, and Madero was doing it in Mexico, which was new. Diaz had never even bothered to do it, because why talk to the people? They don't matter anyway. And Madero was being tolerated for the moment. Now, there's two reasons why Diaz let this happen. Number one, he didn't actually think anything would come of it. He thought that this short, superstitious weirdo would never succeed. And he also fully believed that it would be dangerous to go after him specifically because of who he was. Madero was the son of one of the biggest landowners in the country. Certainly not the biggest. His family was not the one that owned or had stolen 27,000 square miles of land and had outlawed all schools. That guy was a bastard. But he definitely was one of the very rich. And if you go after the son of one of the super wealthy, the other super wealthy are going to get mad. It's a little club, and you aren't in it. The books are closed, and they aren't accepting new members. But if you're born into it, they tend to protect their own. So Diaz lets him do it. And it's a little odd when you think about it, kind of in the abstract, because if it had been anyone else, they would have been arrested or killed. If it was Pancho Villa, he would have been arrested as a bandit because, well, he was a bandit. Okay, that's a bad example. But if it had been Zapata traveling around and giving speeches about land reform and about trying to run against Diaz and get him out of power, he absolutely would have been arrested and probably executed. But Madero doing it under the auspices of presidential elections was fine. It was tolerated. I don't know. Controlled opposition, maybe, was the thought. I don't know. And they're going to lie about the results anyway, so who cares? Now, while this is happening, Pancho Villa has stepped up his harassment of government forces and the Diaz supporters. He expanded his efforts to help the poor, and he very much was pushing for Madero's support in the north. In the south, Zapata was not specifically pushing for Madero's support, but he was pushing for change. He was running and pushing for the only thing he really cared about was land reform. He and his cohorts were running low-level political opposition. They're trying to get their people elected into low offices. Maybe in the future something more could come of it. Who knows? And as the months passed, they weren't arrested and executed. At which point, Zapata begins to get bolder and more vocal about his plans for land reform. In the beginning, he was just kind of testing the waters. They would literally just put up a name of someone running for election and see if anything would happen to them. And if they survived, well, hey, maybe we can go a little bit farther, and a little bit farther, a little bit farther. Or further, rather, not farther. Further is a measure of degree. Farther is a measure of distance. I do apologize for my grammatical error. So Zapata gets more and more bold and vocal about his plans, and both the people in the north and the south, they were apprehensive, but they're becoming bolder and more vocal. The support was no longer a silent, oppressed majority completely resigned to accept how bad things had become. No, it was very vocal, it was very hopeful, very excited, very desperate, and it was very much the majority. The people had awakened. And more importantly, Zapata and Villa had awakened hope. The storm was rising. So Madero's book had sold decently well, but it was more the fact that it existed rather than the number of sales that mattered. And although he was received rather coldly in some cities that he actually went to, he usually did gather crowds and some in very big and influential places, and big crowds too. In Guadalajara and Monterrey, the biggest cities in Mexico, aside from the capital, there were 10,000 people or more every time he would stop by. They went to cheer him on, and when he got to Mexico City, it wasn't 10,000, it was 50,000. And this was when Diaz kind of changed his mind about tolerating Madero. It started small. There were minor interferences. He wouldn't be fined, but his servants would be arrested and fined, the ones that were traveling with him. They would be locked up for a night for nothing at all and then released. He was officially investigated for fraud involving the buying and selling of livestock, which was 100% nonsense. But as these little interferences grew, it became harder and harder to pretend that they weren't happening. And his grandfather, Madero's grandfather, well, he was not a naive young man. He was a very cynical, ultra-wealthy old man who knew what was really going on. And he could recognize what was actually happening. And he knew that this was only happening because Diaz was allowing it to happen on both sides. Madero's only running because Diaz is allowing it. And the interference is beginning because Diaz is allowing it. So he reaches out to Diaz personally, which you can do if you're part of that little club. And he asks him to be lenient, which is an understandable thing. You know, a grandfather asking for understanding about his strange, weird little grandson. He says, hey, there's just something wrong with his head. He believes that the spirits are guiding him and talking to him on a daily basis. Please, please, just let him be. He's just crazy. Don't do anything terrible. Just tolerate him. Nothing's going to happen. And Diaz didn't do anything specifically terrible. But he did have Madero arrested a week before the election. So now Madero is sitting in prison, right when the hope of the people had reached a fever pitch. The election day was huge. All over the country, the people were pouring into churches and polling places, singing songs and cheering for Madero. The election results came in, and it wasn't even close. Diaz had won with 99% of the vote. Apparently, in the entire country of Mexico, with a population of over 15 million people, less than 200 had actually voted for Madero, which is a totally believable number that's definitely not a lie. Maybe the hundreds of thousands of cheering crowds spread all across the country had just forgotten to vote and went out to just have a party and forgetting why they were there. Or maybe it was a lie. It was jaw-droppingly transparent. Nobody believed it. And I mean nobody believed it. But it didn't really matter. It had never mattered before. Why would it matter now, right? The people would just roll over and accept it, right? They always have before. What could possibly go wrong? Having won the election in a landslide, Diaz decided to free Madero because he figures because he's won, he's now firmly in power, and he can be lenient again with the son of one of the wealthiest families in the country. And again, if he had not been the son of one of the wealthiest families in Mexico, this would not have happened this way. But he was, and so it did. They released Madero from prison, and he goes to America. He goes to San Antonio, Texas. He immediately boards a train north, and he did not stop at his home. Do not pass go, do not collect 200 pesos. Just go directly to the border where you will be safe. And he was. In San Antonio, he wrote out his plan. And this time, he really didn't pull any punches about what was happening. The time for half measures was over. The time for working within the system has passed. The people had had their hopes dashed. Now they were not joyful. Now they were angry. Madero declared that the elections that had just been held were completely illegitimate. He declared himself to be the provisional president of Mexico. He called for a general refusal to acknowledge the central government. He called for, and this is where it gets a little bit important, restitution of land to the villages and to the indigenous communities. Now that's going to get the attention of Zapata and all of his supporters in the South. Madero also calls for the freedom of political prisoners. That would be the people that had supported him, but it was also all of the people who had been imprisoned for the last 30 years just for speaking out against Diaz. He calls for freedom of the press. The newspapers must be allowed to speak, or at least to write. Everything he called for appealed to one group or another. The middle class saw that he was trying to break a three-decade-old dictatorship and introduced real political change. The intellectuals saw freedom of the speech and of the press. And the indigenous peoples, and Zapata and Pancho Villa, saw that he was calling for land reform. This matters. This really matters to the people that matter. Whether they are the peasants in their masses or the owners in their haciendas, this matters. Now, he was very vague on the details and the specifics of what it actually meant, but what it actually meant didn't matter. Not at this point, because the people that mattered saw what they wanted to see, and they believed. They really, really believed. It's mind over matter. Well, sort of. In reality, almost everybody was just holding their breath, waiting to see what would happen. The election was in August. He was in San Antonio by September, and on October 5th, he called for everything to begin on November 20th. And almost nobody actually took any action. But almost nobody isn't nobody. On November 20th, there were riots. There were uprisings. Not huge, not massive. We're not talking about huge-scale battles, but they did happen all across northern Mexico on a small scale. And one of the people that actually did rise to fight was a horse thief and an army deserter. He was the killer of his sister's rapist, the man who had been convinced to become a Robin Hood bandit, a growing legend in his own time. When Madero called for a revolution, Pancho Villa said, "Viva!" So in Pancho Villa's home state, there was actually uprising. We're not, again, not massive, but it was happening. We're talking about the burning of a few government buildings, cutting the telegraph lines, blocking the roads so that the army cannot communicate and cannot come in. Pancho Villa rose when Madero asked him. Over the next few weeks, this continues, and it gets bigger and bigger. Nothing succeeds like success. And as the isolated pockets of these minor revolutionary groups see that they are winning and that it's happening in other parts of the country as well, they begin to become more and more bold. Remember how I talked about the mountains and how geographically isolated these areas were? Well, now that comes into play. So the military is going to try to come into a specific area, and before they can get there, the bridge is destroyed, or the pass is blocked. The army is cut off, and so you can ambush them. You can kill the soldiers, and you can take their weapons. You can take their horses. You can give them to the peasants. The peasants then rise with weapons and horses to support the revolution. The dictator Diaz radically misjudged the situation. The country hated him, and it was ripe for rebellion. And so for the next 6 months, the entire country is on fire. Madero is returning to Mexico. Pancho Villa is rising in the north. Emiliano Zapata is rising in the south. Villa and Zapata had different goals. So while Villa is raiding and attacking government and military posts in the north, Zapata is doing something completely different. He was a single-issue guy. And his issue was, of course, land reform. That's the only thing he cares about. So as his contribution to the rebellion, what he does to rise is to start seizing the haciendas and forcibly tear down the fences to give the land back to the peasants. That orchard in his father's village that had been stolen, they got it back. By 1911, the rebels had attacked the strategic town of Ciudad Juarez, which just literally means City of Juarez. It's across the river from El Paso, Texas. El Paso was symbolically significant because that's where President Taft and Diaz had met only 2 years before for some joint ceremonies. In Juarez, there is an actual battle. 3,500 revolutionary forces were going up against the government's 675. The Americans were viewing this as entertainment. I mean that literally. There are pictures of the Americans watching the battle sitting on the tops of hotels with binoculars and telescopes, just enjoying the festivities. There were postcards made showing a dozen or so businessmen watching from the roof garden of the hotel. And on that picture was the caption, "Paso del Norte, the only hotel in the world offering its guests safe, comfortable place to view a Mexican revolution." Wow, that's some extreme tourism right there. Watch a battle, drink some drinks, then buy a postcard. Unbelievable, but true. That's a direct quote. But it's not just entertainment for the gringos. This is an actual battle. People are fighting and they're dying. So it's a little morbid to view as entertainment, but it's also a little dangerous. There were bullets that flew into the United States, and there were some American citizens who were wounded. And I gotta say, that falls under the category of play stupid games, win stupid prizes. If you are sitting and drinking cocktails to watch a battle unfold in front of you with live ammunition, well, you might get hit by a bullet. I don't have a lot of sympathy there. So in the North, the revolution is successful. Madero has come back to Mexico, and he is moving southward, fairly slowly. But he is in Mexico, and the northern Mexican people are rising to him. They are rising to support him. He has the full, complete confidence of Pancho Villa and his men. And the spirits, of course. Their daily conversations were filled with praise. At the other end of the country, more than 12,000 peasants had joined Zapata. They had actually seized multiple haciendas, and they were forcibly distributing the land back to the people. And he was actually refusing the normal bribes, the kind of thing that would have happened for people that were less dedicated. You just pay him off, and the rich people get to keep their land. He's refusing the bribes. Now, I realize that this is something of a touchy subject in theory, but in reality, it really isn't, not in this case. Zapata was very, very clear that everything should be done legitimately. He very specifically ordered that the colonial titles would be respected, that if the land that had been held by families for 100 years, they'd be able to keep their land as long as they could prove that they actually owned it. And this goes back to before the Mexican Revolution. Before the Mexican War for Independence 100 years before. So you could actually look at the original Spanish documents from Spain and see who owned the land. And if it was a peasant family or a communal orchard, for villages, they were given back to the people. And if it was an ultra-wealthy landowner that had those documents, well, he got to keep it. And if they couldn't find any record of any payment to anyone for the land that had just been stolen, well, now they're going to take it back. This thing was absolutely rampant. And over the last 100 years, 95% of the peasants, of the indigenous peoples, had no land. Now, that wasn't true 100 years before, but all of it, 95% of the people had had their land taken from them. And now Zapata is taking it back. All across the South and Central Mexico, after decades of expansion by force, the haciendas were being broken up because, as it turned out, when you had to actually produce the documents, they didn't exist. The overwhelmingly vast majority of the land that the haciendas controlled was completely illegitimate. They had just stolen it. All of it. I mean, it boggles the mind a little bit in modern society, but they had literally just taken it. Well, no more. Viva la revolución. Zapata was very specifically asked if he was supporting Madero. That's a legitimate question. Because he was trying to come back and overthrow Diaz. And Zapata, the true revolutionary, said, "I am simply returning the land to its rightful owners. I am not concerned with larger matters." But unfortunately for Zapata, larger matters were concerned with him. He was not going to be able to stay neutral, because there was great resistance to returning the stolen land. There were federal troops that were trying to stop them from breaking up the haciendas, from tearing down the walls and giving the land back, and so there were pitched battles in the South. Peasants versus soldiers, guns versus numbers. And usually the peasants ended up winning because they had the numbers, and they had big numbers. One of the victories they won was because Zapata had laid siege to a city called Cuautla, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. But the siege came to an end when they took a huge amount of gasoline and poured it into the aqueducts. Gasoline floats. It's lighter than water, less dense than water. So they wait for a while as the gasoline just spreads through the aqueducts, and then they lit it on fire. This created massive flames throughout the little town, at which point the federal soldiers surrendered. Diaz sent his people to try to negotiate with the rebels in the north and the south, and they were unsuccessful. Because at the same time that they were trying to negotiate this, Diaz was sending a bill to the Mexican Congress prohibiting re-election. No more elections. Period. They're illegal. Diaz only gave up when the President of the United States got involved. William Howard Taft deployed 20,000 soldiers to the border and dispatched several Navy ships to the most important Mexican ports. It made it very clear that Madero had the support of the United States. And because of that, the finance minister of Mexico said to Diaz, if the internal war continues, the United States will intervene. Because the U.S. was not going to allow instability to wreck their interests. So the old man then understood that his days at the National Palace were over. And so he left. Now, what's interesting about that, and what a few people, if you're listening closely, may have just caught, is that the reason that the United States intervened was because they wanted to protect their own interests. And their interests were the money that they were making from Mexico. It is a strange parallel with the Mexican War for Independence 100 years before. And if you are really into high-level historical study on a PhD level, or maybe just a master's, I don't know, here's a fascinating topic. Before World War II, it was extremely common, after a war, to force the loser to pay huge amounts of money to the winner. This goes back thousands of years. In the more modern world of the last 500 years or so, these payments became very, very, very large, and they would last for decades. It had the effect of crippling the defeated nation so that they couldn't rebuild or rearm. In Mexico, the restitution payments that had been made to the great powers of Europe, France, Spain, and Britain, and to a much lesser extent the United States, were crippling their economy for many, many decades. France went to war with Mexico 50 years before this, when Mexico stopped paying their war debt. That's where Cinco de Mayo comes from. I covered that in a previous episode. So here is the interesting part. The United States said they would intervene to protect their interests, but their interests are no longer restitution payments being paid by the government of Mexico to the government of the United States. No. Now it's different. It's more modern, and it's all private. Their interests were in oil, silver, mineral rights, control of the railroads. At that point, the United States companies owned more than 90% of all of the mineral rights in the entire country. That meant 90% of the oil. It's no longer payments being made to a government. Now it's money flowing to the biggest companies and the moneyed interests of the United States. And in order to protect that, that's what the U.S. was going to go to war over. They are trying to prevent a massive uprising, and so they're supporting Madero. And the reason that they did is because he was not Zapata breaking up the haciendas, and he wasn't Pancho Villa, the Robin Hood bandit. Madero was the son of one of the very wealthy landowners, and they thought they could work with him. And that's not a theory. The reason that they thought they could work with him is because while all of this was happening, Madero's family had literally been in Washington, D.C. lobbying Congress and trying to talk to the president. When it all went crazy in November, Madero's grandfather had immediately gone to Washington, D.C. He called in every favor from every friend and acquaintance from everywhere he could. He hired lobbyists, he bribed politicians, and he convinced them to support Madero. He was successful. And because he was successful, the revolution only lasted 6 months. The reason it was quick was because Diaz stepped down. The reason he stepped down is because the U.S. interests had been threatened, and the U.S. had threatened to intervene. Now, did those interests align with Zapata and Pancho Villa? No, absolutely not. Fighting against a common enemy does not mean that you're on the same side. So Diaz flees. On the night of May 21st in 1911, under the light of some car headlights, the Treaty of Ciudad Juarez was signed. Diaz, as the president, would immediately resign, and the vice president as well. There would be a provisional presidency, and a new election would be held. And in return, all of the revolutionaries would cease all their hostilities immediately. It was successful. Almost exactly 6 months after Madero called for the uprising, it's over. Although not really. Because if you know anything about what I've said about the history of Mexico, you can always sum it up with, and then it got worse. And that is exactly what happened. But it didn't get worse quite yet. Diaz resigns. They hold the elections. Madero wins wholeheartedly. He had the support of damn near everybody. Diaz boards a German ship that was going to take him to Spain. It was a luxury room, as befitting a man of his stature. There was a band. They're having parties, saying goodbye. And one of the last people to come to his cabin, his private cabin, to say goodbye was an army general, a middle-aged man with a gray mustache named Huerta. Huerta hugged Diaz and told him that he could always count on the army. And the key here is that Madero didn't know it, and he didn't realize it. He was naive, and he only listened to the voices in his head. So he did not replace any of the people in power, even when his brother and all of his close advisors begged him to put his own supporters in the key positions, like removing Huerta and putting in another army general who actually supported him instead of had been in charge of fighting against him. I mean, it just boggles the mind. But he didn't do it. He kept Huerta, the general who had sworn to Diaz that he would always support him. He should have replaced the leaders, but he didn't. The spirits told him not to. All right, so now Madero's president. What are you going to do now? Well, that's the real question, isn't it? He was a very naive individual who thought that it was him and him alone and his book and his spirits that had roused the country. It absolutely was not. He may have been the spark that lit the fire, but he was not the fire. He may have been what the opposition coalesced around, but that is pretty much all he was. He was acceptable from the point of view from the United States, but he is just one man. And at this point, he's a man alone because he didn't put any of his supporters in the positions of power that he should have. All of the different factions had radically different goals in mind, and everything that was happening was being driven by bigger powers and larger movements. So you had the United States, which wants to protect the mineral rights and the interest of the big business. You had the wealthy, who had supported him because he was one of them. You had the middle class, who had supported him because they're going to expand voting rights and introduce democratic representation, grant them freedom of speech, freedom of the press, that sort of thing. And then you had the peasants. And then you had the people at the bottom who wanted their land. They just wanted their land back. That's all they cared about. They didn't care about freedom of speech. They didn't care about freedom of the press. They did not care about democratic assembly or direct elections or anything like that. All they wanted was their land. And the last factor, the last group, the army, the military, hated him. They hated him because they had just been fighting him. The army hated him because he had been beating the hell out of them all the way down Mexico. The generals hated him because he had just overthrown their leader, and he didn't replace them. And the peasants, Pancho Villa, well, Pancho Villa just wants to be Pancho Villa, the gentleman bandit, the Robin Hood, the folk hero, the legend in his own time. And he actually does get what he wants, so congratulations there. And it's Zapata, the fanatic about land reform, that gets really mad. So what are you going to do? All of these things come together, and you're supposed to do all of these things at the same time. So the very first thing he did was to institute reforms that are very quick and easy, and that is, he loosened up the controls on freedom of the press, which, hey, that's a noble thing. But what that meant was that all of the people that would then disagree with everything that he did were going to broadcast it to the high heavens. And that's not something that the country of Mexico was used to. Here in America, we have freedom of speech, and everyone is pretty used to having more than one side talk about how great someone is, or how terrible someone is, or how mediocre someone is, or how sleepy someone is, or how crazy someone is, or what have you. But back in Mexico, at this time, they were not. It had been decades and decades and decades of complete, total, 100% control of the press. And now that you have a free press that can say whatever they want, they're going to do it. And they're going to do it in a way that just is going to add fuel to the fire. Everything bad is going to be portrayed as worse. Every problem is going to be blamed on Madero, even if it has nothing to do with him or is in an impossible situation. And the key is that it's all going to be believed, because the people of Mexico at this point really didn't have the wherewithal or the knowledge to understand that not everything you put in headlines is accurate. Now that the Diaz control is gone, the press can say whatever they want, and a lot of the people are going to believe everything they read. And I shouldn't criticize that, because we have the same problem here in America. To a certain extent. All right, so Madero did not do land reform. When that starts off on the wrong foot with Zapata and the northern rebels as well. In the north, this isn't Pancho Villa, it's another guy, it's a guy named Pascal Orozco. He was one of the very first supporters on the actual November 20th day, and he didn't stop when the treaty was signed. He did not stop raiding government organizations. He had not laid down his arms. And when the treaty was signed, he didn't stop. So now he's fighting against Madero. And Madero doesn't really have a choice. He's got to go send the army to fight him. So he goes to the military and he says, now you've got to go back up there and fight these guys. And these are Diaz supporters and Diaz troops who are now being ordered by the guy they used to be attacking to go attack the people that they were used to be attacking. They're being ordered by Madero to attack Madero's peasant revolutionaries in the northern part of the country. And while that may be understandable, it made a lot of people very, very angry. So from their rather limited point of view, the peasants, they had supported Madero in the battle against the army. Madero wins, takes control of the army, and then sends the army to attack them. So yeah, they're not happy. You're going to lose a lot of support by doing this. And he does. He continues his reforms in Mexico City. These are more intellectual. Freedom of the press, for separation of church and state. He's addressing some of the minor issues of the Catholic Church and land ownership. But he was not addressing hacienda land ownership. He's talking about taxes and who actually owns the land where the churches themselves are built on. He's talking about education and opening up the haciendas to schools. And Zapata in the South is getting really, really angry because he only cares about land reform and giving the stolen land back to the peasants. So Zapata starts moving towards Mexico City to put pressure on Madero to actually address his supporters, to address the issue of land reform. And when he gets to Mexico City, the people in Mexico City are absolutely terrified. Because the press had painted Zapata and his supporters as these bloodthirsty barbarians who would slaughter you in the streets and steal everything that you have. They are the worst people, the oh my gosh, these damn socialists, they're just going to take everything and kill everybody. Because that is what the Diaz dictatorship had wanted people to think. And that's what the headlines in the newspaper had said. So that's what the people in Mexico City believed. And when Zapata and his army got there, they realized very, very quickly that they had been lied to. These guys were shoeless peasants. They were very, very lightly armed. And the main impact they had on the city was they went in some of the bigger areas and were just knocking on doors asking people for food. Because they had walked there. They had not done what armies frequently do, and that's live off the land and take food from the surrounding areas, because Zapata wouldn't let them do it. So when they get to Mexico City, they run out of food, they're starving, and they go begging for food. They didn't steal anything. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't rape anybody. They didn't take any land. They didn't take anything at all. They were just asking for food. It was kind of a wake-up call for a lot of the people in Mexico City that they really had been lied to. Zapata and Madero meet. Zapata tells him that you have to enact land reform. The new president then told Zapata that they would no longer need his services, that the peasants would have to surrender all of their weapons because the revolution is now over. Zapata said, no, we will not surrender our weapons because we don't trust you. We will not surrender our weapons until the land has been returned. I don't trust you, and we don't trust the army. And you shouldn't trust the army either. They will betray you. Madero should have listened to that warning. So now they're having an argument about what should be done with the land in the south and what the peasants should be doing with their weapons. And Zapata uses an example, he gives an example, and I think this is a really good one, so I'm going to take the time to actually say it all out. Zapata says to Mr. Madero, "If I, taking advantage of the fact that I am carrying a gun and you are not, take your golden watch and I keep it for myself, and after a while we meet each other both armed and with equal force, would you have the right to demand that I return the watch to you?" Madero was surprised. And he says, "Of course, General. I would even have the right to demand compensation for the time that you have had my watch and I was denied the use of it." Zapata takes a few steps forward, gets right in his face and said, "And that is exactly what has happened to us in the state of Morelos. A few hacienda owners have stolen the lands of the entire communities, not just a few families, but entire villages and towns, all the land. My soldiers, the peasants, and the people have sent me to tell you with all respect that the restitution of their land should be carried out immediately." This was a demand, and Madero ignored it. He just didn't do it. Maybe he didn't do it because he had bitten off more than he could chew. Maybe he didn't do it because he didn't have the power to do it. Maybe he didn't do it because he did not have the supporters in the key places of the government that would have been necessary. So for whatever reason, he doesn't do it. Emiliano Zapata is extremely disillusioned by Madero. He returns to the South. He ends up creating what's called the Plan of Ayala, A-Y-A-L-A, which, by the way, is just a beautiful name. It's the name of a town where he wrote this plan. The Plan of Ayala was a 15-point plan that almost entirely was Emiliano Zapata yelling at Madero. But there were a few important points, three of them out of the 15. Now, this is actually where the rubber meets the road on land reform. Basically, he says that the property that has been taken by the people, by the landlords, the haciendas, the jefes, will be returned to the citizens who have titles to that property. This is what I referred to earlier. He's literally going back into this old Spanish records, and if you had the titles, you could have your land back. Tribunals will be held after the revolutionary victory to determine who the land goes to. The usurpers who think they have the right to the land or the right to any of the goods produced by the land may state their claims before the special tribunals. In other words, you can plead your case, but you can probably imagine how that was going to go. It was going to rather be one-sided. Maybe, but probably not as bad as you might think, because when Zapata was breaking up the haciendas before Madero was elected, he actually was respecting the land rights of the giant landowners if they had the documentation. It's just that most of the time they didn't. So he goes a step further. He says that 1/3 of the property of the Mexican monopolies will be taken and redistributed to the villages and the individuals without land. That would be 95% of the population. So even if the hacienda owners did have a claim and a legitimate title to the land, 1/3 of it was going to be taken and they would be compensated. And that is a very important point, especially that last word. He was not saying we're going to take everything. He wasn't even saying that we're going to take 1/3. He was saying that you are going to sell 1/3 to the government. We will pay you for it. And we are going to give that to the people. Which honestly is not as radical as it sounds. From a historical standpoint, this was actually kind of a common thing back in the 19th century. And before then, certainly breaking up the feudal lands way back when, all across Europe, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. Anyway, so if they had stolen the land and they could prove they had stolen the land, they have to give it back. And if they didn't steal the land, then they have to sell 1/3 of it to the government. It's eminent domain. They didn't call it that, but that's what it is. That's what we call it here in America. Anyway, So it's not nearly as radical as it sounds, but it was certainly ignored. So at this point, we enter in the great villain. This evil SOB. This effing guy. Henry Lane Wilson. Wow. I mean, this guy. He was the ambassador from the United States to Mexico. But at the same time, he was also the lawyer and the lobbyist for the largest oil company in the world, Standard Oil. That's illegal now. But back then, sure, go ahead. So he's Standard Oil's representation in Mexico, and he carries the authority of the United States, in theory. But what he starts to do is things that were 100% not allowed. It was illegal to do what he did, even back then. Of course it's illegal now, but back then it was illegal. Absolutely without question, beyond the scope of his duties or his job, anything that he'd been authorized by the President of the United States. So the villain, the evil Henry Lane Wilson, starts planning a coup. He hated Madero, and he was an unabashed supporter of Diaz. And as soon as he realizes that Madero has lost the support, he jumps on it. He's going to take advantage of this situation. Madero has lost the support of Zapata and the revolutionaries in the South. He has lost the support of Pancho Villa and Orozco and the actual bandits in the North. He does not have the support of the army because they're still loyal to Diaz. And the middle class, the intellectuals, they have turned on him because the reforms that he had promised them did not come fast enough. And the only thing that he did succeed in quickly was the freedom of the press, which helped to turn everybody against him. So the evil Henry Lane Wilson begins to organize an incredibly bloody coup against the government of Mexico. He did this by himself. This is not the U.S. government trying to overthrow Madero. They had just put him into power by threatening to intervene on his behalf. No. This is one guy, one absolutely vile man, deciding that he's just going to start a war. And we will finish that in the next episode. This is one of the darkest chapters in the history of the United States and Mexico, is what the evil Henry Lane Wilson did. And I'm going to cover it, and I'm going to pull no punches. As a man with an army background, I was shocked to learn at how the generals were literally betraying their own soldiers at the behest of the evil Henry Lane Wilson. The loss of life was astounding. The fires that swept Mexico would last for years. Pancho Villa becomes a legend in his own time, and as for Zapata and Madero, well, we'll cover that all in about 2 weeks.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.